in association with Newsarama.com. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with the dude himself, Steve Rude, who discusses his return to the worlds of Nexus and the Moth in his self-published line of books, Rude Dude Comics. We'll also talk about the beginnings of his relationship with Mike Baron, his looks back at things like the direct market of the 1980s, his constant inspiration by guys like Alex Toth and, of course, Jack Kirby, and plans for the future, which include not only new tales of Nexus and the Moth, but also an interesting anthology book, Amazing Dude Tales. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. InStock Trades has a huge selection of product from Steve Rude, including books like the Nexus Archives, which retail at $49.95, the InStock Trade price $32.47, and you can get the hardcover volumes from 1 through 7 at InStockTrades.com. In addition, you'll also find the Moth Trade paperback, which retails for $12.95 at InStock Trades, $8.42. And don't forget about InStock Trades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, monthly specials 45 to 75% off every month. For more information, visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. The conversation begins with me asking the dude how things got started between him and Mike Baron.
I am curious how you and Mike first got together. I'm assuming that led to your first professional work.
Before I met Baron, I had finally made the move that all 18-year-olds have to make, which is you're basically kicked out of the house.
Okay.
And I was kicked out in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, which is the capital. That's where I was born. And I just thought, well, if I'm going to move anywhere, and I can't move across the street or in the dorms around Waukesha like I'd been doing, but I had to make a clean break that had some distance to it. And I had friends down at Madison that I grew up with that I wanted to see. I just knew that instinctively that that's where I needed to go. And, of course, as most people might do in life, that rely on their instincts, they always prove to be right. So I moved down to Madison, and this was 1978. I remember about 1978. It was the year that I had just gotten out of art school. It was a 4-year art school, but I only lasted 2 years. That's because I got bored with the art school, and they didn't teach me a whole lot. But the things I learned from that particular school, I think. You always learn some good things in some things that you wish you learned a lot more of, and it seemed to be based almost exclusively on how good the teachers were. I had a painting teacher, and I don't know how he could really call himself that, because he didn't teach painting. He just walked around and he kind of looked at what we were doing as we floundered with oil paint and things like that.
Okay.
And I'd been waiting for years to get into painting and try what everyone else seemed to have done long before I ever tried it, oil paint and watercolor, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's mostly oil paint. You know, it was paint this and paint that. And I remember Frazetta had just put his first book out at exactly around that time.
Okay.
And we were all just real psyched about Frazetta. I'd never seen him before. But when his book came out, you know, we all talked about him when we all got the book. And we were just floored by this guy. And we were kind of all trying to paint like him. But I didn't know what I was doing, and the teacher sure didn't help. there were some teachers that were good, and there were some that were bad. But, you know, I walked out of that school thinking, well, geez, am I supposed to be an artist now? Another thing I remember from those days, because there's always really good stuff that happens, no matter where you go, even if overall, maybe I didn't learn that much, but I remember you're with these this group of people that you're all kind of trying to find out what it's all about with. You're all trying to learn just anything. You're trying to get a hold on something that you feel like you're about to have an identity as an artist. And you're all in it together. You're all so young, and you're just trying to discover these things. It kind of produces this feeling of closeness with people that I've always liked. And I remember towards the end of the second year, before I got out of there, I was starting to get real close to some of the guys that hung around there, and it was fascinating. These guys, there was two people that were exceptional. They were far better than I was, and also there was a lot of people that weren't as good as I was. It's just kind of a natural thing that we all have going into an art school. You want to find out where you're, kind of where you rank.
Okay.
And there is these two guys that were exceptional, and they were, personality wise, they were completely different. They were like, one was a complete nerd. that was another one of the guys that was really good, and the other guy was Mr. Cool.
Okay.
And we all just thought he was, you know, the coolest. And I just remember eventually, once I got to know these guys and I had more classes with them, looking at what they did and thinking, well, they're way better than I am. You know, what am I going to do about that? And the answer was, to this day, it kind of remains the same way of thinking, which is I have to buckle down and really get into it and get these sketchbooks out and try to learn and figure things out.
Kind of outwork them in terms of like more output and just work at the craft harder.
Yeah, I didn't know any other way to get better.
Okay.
The teachers weren't helping me at that particular school.
What things were you lacking, do you think, at that point?
Oh, well, everything.
Okay.
I had heard about other people my age that had taken painting classes in high school. And I remember thinking, because I went to this pretty small high school in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
that, well, geez, you know, they never taught me anything in high school. I mean, I wanted to paint, but they didn't have a setup for that.
Okay.
And so I never really learned anything about that. So when these other clowns came into class, these two guys that were wizards, you know, they were already expert oil painters. You know, that sure opened up my eyes, because no matter what I did, I couldn't beat these guys at what they were good at. And that was one of the things I learned about art school. They were just too darn good.
Had you found your style yet at that point, or were you? What do you think you were trying to do back then that maybe was different from what eventually became your comic book style, for example?
Well, it was completely in its infancy. There was really no style that I thought that I had.
Okay.
The only references I had, I remember the first day of figure drawing, where I drew from a real figure. Actually, I was 19 when this happened. I wasn't 18. I remember looking at the model and drawing a Kirby version of the model standing in front of me. Well, nobody does that unless they're crazy or they just grew up in comic books. I remember that being kind of a laughable memory for figure drawing class.
I could tell, based on other interviews that you've done, that Kirby was such a massive influence on you. And I know that a lot of choices of projects that you've made at the big two companies were always properties that had Kirby's imprint on them. You know, from Captain America to one of my personal favorite team-ups that you did back in the day, the Hulk and Superman. And just the look that you gave each of those characters, it really was, in terms of the Hulk, I mean, it really felt like those first six issues, that very early Hulk period. And Superman, am I nuts? Did I see, not Wayne Boring, I don't really know where to put your Superman, because it definitely was a retro Superman and a very cool-looking 50s Superman. And I think your Clark Kent looked like a Wayne Boring Clark Kent to me. Am I wrong? Is that where you think, was that your line of thinking?
No, actually, well, the Hulk, certainly. God knows, you know, that was what defined the Hulk for me, is those early issues. But for Superman, Superman was funny because I never read him as a kid. And, you know, it kind of all goes back to those early years when you're I don't know, 11 years old, 10, 11 years old, things like that. And you're looking at this stuff. But no, I never read any of the Superman comics at all. And then one day, years later, when I was done in Madison, the Superman that I came to identify with the most came on TV one night, and I didn't know what the hell to make of this thing. I was was on a show called Night Flight. You remember that show from the 80s? It had to be from, let me think, early.
Oh, yeah, on USA.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I picked this up on my little TV, but all of a sudden I just happened to switch it on one night, and it's almost like, you know, a moment with destiny. Here comes these cartoons with Superman, but they weren't like anything I'd seen. They weren't the Filmation junk versions that I remember from a kid. They were theatrical quality animation.
Oh, these were the Fleischer cartoons.
Yeah, they were. I found out that they were the Fleischer cartoons, and I was just transfixed by them.
Oh, that's great.
So that's where my Superman came from, and of course, those cartoons came out in what, 38 or something, 39?
Pretty much at the beginning, yeah.
I think it was the very beginning.
You know.
Yeah. So, and of course, that was they came directly from the Schuster Superman, which I still look at as the funnest to look at. The most exciting for me.
No, that's great, and it was we had seen before in Treasury Edition size, you know, DC and Marvel team ups where Superman and the Hulk fought, and it was very modern looking, and taking nothing away from the guys that were working on those books, and I think it was probably Russ Andrew, and it was great to just see this very retro, both of these guys at the early stages of their career, Superman and the Hulk kind of fighting each other, and you had a great Roger Stern script, but really the art just really popped on that series, and it was such a fun book to just look at. Something that fell out of a wormhole from, you know, like, you know, this cross between 1940 and 1962. So it was great.
Well, you know, as someone who does this stuff, there's no greater thing you could hear from anyone than to hear that they were just plain fun. And fun is a major ingredient of what I'm doing with why I formed the Rude Dude Company. We'll get into that a lot later, but there's so much other cool ground to cover, but I think the coolest thing that happened when I was doing the Hulk Superman, besides working with Glenn Greenberg, who is just a marvelously nice guy, is Harris. Bob Harris was the editor-in-chief of Marvel at that time.
Okay.
And apparently, word got back to me when he saw the pencils that I had done. He says, what's taken somebody so long to do this version of the Hulk? And obviously, I didn't know what to say about that, except I agree. I mean, what took me to come along isn't that the coolest version of the Hulk you can do?
Yeah.
So why did it take forever for somebody? It seemed kind of silly.
Yeah, at that same time or near that same time, you did that Bruce Jones Captain America story, What Price Glory. I believe it was simultaneous to the Cassidy revamp of Cap. You know, there was a very kind of introspective Captain America being portrayed in the John Neighbor and John Cassidy Cap. Meanwhile, you and Jones had Cap, doing what he should be doing, bouncing off the walls and, you know, fighting secret agents and, you know, having a good time.
I did not see those other Captain America series, but it makes me wonder, you know, when I hear those kind of things from people like yourself, how many other people think like that? As far as like, they get this excitement feeling from someone who's basically just trying to capture the glory moments of the books I grew up on. And how come more people don't do that? And if so many people tend to like that kind of thing. Well, I wonder if they do tend to like that kind of thing, because obviously, you know, a lot of people at Marvel considered me they were wondering why I was doing work like that, why I was riffing Kirby and things like that. I remember hearing something about, you know, Rude can draw anything. Why does he want to do this Kirby stuff? And I don't know if they couldn't, you know, possibly understand. Maybe they just couldn't get it. I mean. But to me, it was all about, you know, this is what Captain America was to me.
Sure.
You know, if you want to know what Cap is, I'll just throw you Tales of Suspense.
Yeah.
And here, check this out. What do you think? How does it make you feel? Do you like it? Do you get excited? Is there anything better than this? And then I'll give you something from any other period that they weren't doing anything like that. And I like to know what people think about that, too.
Well, and
comparison-wise.
There should be room for both. I mean, that's because I'll admit I like a lot of what's happening in the writing side of today's comic books, and I like that there is a depth to characterization that maybe wasn't there when, you know, you're only a few years older than me, but I think we shared a lot of the same reading years. You know, the books then and everything, they were geared towards a younger audience, and, you know, characterization, I think, had to be a little more simplified. I mean, there was still, you know, there was a big difference between the way Captain America was being portrayed and the way Reed Richards was being portrayed, or Bruce Banner, or anybody else, but I like the conversations that I see in a lot of today's comic books, because I think it does add to character. But I do think that, you know, there was nothing wrong with the dynamic action that we had for decades from Marvel and, you know, the better DC artists, you know, guys that were, you know, like, you know, when Neil Adams came on and really kind of made things happen on things like Deadman and things like that.
Yeah, the whole argument of, you know, back then versus today. All I can tell you is that what they did back then suited me completely and completed all my ideas of how far comic books should really go, because today they take them into a realm that is completely different than what I enjoyed. So ergo, I don't enjoy many of today's comics because of that.
Okay. I wanted to go back. I do want to know the beginnings of Nexus. So, you come out of art school. You've only been there for 2 years. Did you want to do comics? I mean, it's, you know, obviously it sounded like you're more excited about, you know, really learning portraits and moving on to being a more commercial artist versus, you know, what was there in comic books. What led you to comic books?
No, I was entirely focused on comic books, John.
Cool.
Was going to be my life. Portraits was just something portraits and portrait level expertise was just another way of doing better comics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there painted comics? I mean, I guess there were. I mean, there were certainly painted covers, and and also you had more lavish illustration coming from, I don't know, even the Warren publications, I'm guessing, back in the 60s and stuff. Because, you know, there was Kirby, and Kirby did his thing, but it was kind of cartoony. You know, the Lou Fiennes and the Reed Crandalls, and I'm trying to think of some of the real draftsmen that, like, you know, that were more Milton Caniff guys than were cartoony guys. I'm just, you know, wondering where that, you know, if that movement was still there, you know, as far as, you know, finer art.
Well, geez, the only people that were doing painted covers that I remember back in that period in the early '80s was me and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Okay, yeah,
that's all I recall from that. And I was thinking of the painted cover aspect for Nexus because I think because I my interests were expanded beyond just line art.
Okay.
And I, in to find people that were expanded beyond line art, I had to go to illustrators. And so that's where people like Andrew Loomis and other people that were accessible in the library came about for me.
So was Nexus your creation, or was it you and Mike? I mean, what was the genesis of Nexus?
It was entirely Barron's.
Okay.
Nexus was entirely Barron's. Barron works for money. I work for art, you know. So Barron was commissioned by some guys local to Madison. They were a distribution company.
This is Capital City.
That's right, Capital City Comics.
Okay.
Or a distribution, I mean. And Barron was real aggressive about getting in the face of these guys and saying, hey, you know, there's a new movement about to happen where we're looking at guys like you to possibly try and publish comic books. You know, I'm a writer and I have an artist, Steve Rood. Let's see if we can get it on here. How did he find you? Oh, that's one of those funny things that you look back on and you know you might see a sense of workings, inner workings of things that are kind of I don't want to say destiny, that's such a cliche, but this thing's coming together.
Okay.
At the right time, which we see all the time, don't we, John? You know, throughout our life, we've seen that kind of stuff take place. How did that work out? I was doing some comic strip for the school newspaper, and I decided, well, hell, you know, I'm not just stuck giving it to these guys at the newspaper that don't pay me anything. Why don't I take what I've done and bring it to some places that are nearby the school where I live and see if I can get paid for this stuff?
Okay.
Even I wanted to get paid. So I brought this stuff by to this guy, to this local Madison paper, just a small time kind of a thing. And he said, well, we don't have much use for this stuff. Why don't you give this guy a call? His name is Mike Barron. I said, okay, you know. So I called up Barron, and we got together, and it was a very brief, business-like, dry kind of a meeting, which is keeping in tune to the way Barron's personality is sometimes. And we started to do these stories that Barron had thought up. The first one was about an encyclopedia salesman in the future.
Okay.
I remember this 24-page book took me like a year to do. But I was learning, and I was having a good time. And I was keeping busy in my little room at the YMCA. And so we got that done, and it didn't go anywhere, so we did a couple more things. In the meantime, I think 1980 approached, and there was something in the air that was going on that was fascinating. I think from that thing in the air that was going on, Barron and I created Nexus. But Barron created the whole backbone of the story.
Okay.
And I remember going over to his house a lot back in Madison. Barron lived over in town about 20 minutes away, and I remember I had to take the bus over there. And I remember for some reason, most of the times going over there where the weather was freezing.
Well, it was Wisconsin, so I can understand that.
Yeah, and Madison gets so bloody cold, death feeling cold. But come to think of it, you know, I'm remembering a couple times when it was warm out, always preferable. And Barron started to tell me about this character. We did not have the name first, though, which was interesting. The name came later on, but Barron had this idea of, you know, the basic premise of this guy who would, you know, go into this tank and he would have these nightmares. You know, we call them dreams, but they're actually not dreams; they're nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who's ever had nightmares in their life knows how horrible these things are. And that's what would happen to Nexus. He would go in, have the nightmare, come out, and he would know that he had to go and find the guy that was the cause of the nightmares and polish him off.
Well, and what I always loved about Nexus was the, not juxtaposition, because it always blended well together, but how cartoony the aliens were and how beautifully classic the humans were, the humanoids were.
And that was my weird, you know, I don't know, what do you call it? I can't think of the word. I just had all these different influences that just came out. They just come out. I don't know where they. I do know where they come from. There was a lot of Dr. Seuss and.
Okay.
And I remember when I created the visual stuff for someone like Dave, I was thinking of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, okay.
And Sandra Peel was actually, her and Dave's roles were actually reversed. Sandra Peel was actually someone who was just hanging out in Ireland for the longest time, and I created her based on my own preferences about gorgeous women.
Well, you got good taste, man.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know,
pretty amazing.
Blonde and just gorgeous. I mean, does anyone ever draw ugly women in comics? No, we all draw these beautiful, beautiful girls because, I don't know, without getting Freudian, I mean, why do we do that? Is it just because they're more fun to draw? Is it just fun to be able to draw a beautiful girl?
I'm sure it helps the audience. I think the audience prefers looking at a beautiful girl, so I think that...
Yeah, well, I guess so, because, you know, I never remember anyone in a comic book that was a lead female looking ugly.
No, I mean, no, only villains like Granny Goodness and, you know, people like that.
I don't know. Did that answer the question?
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, yeah. And my other question is, and I'm guessing it might be this encyclopedia salesman, but, you know, what led you to the backdrop of space, or, like, what did you do to kind of, you know, get prepared to draw some of the spacescapes that you ended up drawing in Nexus?
Well, I thought about Space Ghost.
Okay.
That's what I was going on in my head.
Great, man, I'm telling you, I was just such a fan of that series as well. I mean, and that being a little bit younger, it totally hit me when I was 4 years old, and that really was an incredible Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because Space Ghost was something that I had never even... once it got off the air, you know, back then, you know, people my age understood it to be, well, that was it. You know, that it's off the air. You never see it again. It was canceled. It had 2 years. Now it's gone forever. You just have your memories of the thing. And little did I not foresee later on was that they would bring these shows back. I remember they brought back. They must have been looking for something to throw on Saturday morning because they didn't have anything new. But they brought back Space Ghost and Frankenstein Jr. and
the Herculoids.
Yeah, eventually they brought almost all that stuff back in some form or not. And then, you know, and then the videotapes came out and we had those and then the DVD finally came out after all these decades of time passing.
Did you have that
show? I tell you, when the good ones, the ones that were not, you know, hit. I kind of trace it back to good or bad dialogue.
Okay.
On the show, because they were all visually pretty good.
Oh yeah.
And when they had certain shows, generally the ones that were laid out by Alex Toth and Homer Jonas, and they had dialogue that wasn't aimed at kids. Then they succeeded tremendously well, and I still look at them and have get that kind of a little chill going on about, you know, the way they had the music, the tremendously powerful music that, boy, I look for that nowadays, John, and I did in cartoons, and I don't see anything that ever equaled those, the sound effects or the music, the soundtrack of those old HB shows. They were just chilling sometimes.
Did you buy that Rhino? Box set of CDs called Picnic Basket that really had all the scores and sound effects from all the Hanna-Barbera stuff?
Son of a gun, no, but I have friends that maybe did get those, and they would send me the cassettes. So, my God, just listening to that old stuff and hearing the stories about people that were down there when they were recording this just gives me the willies.
I don't remember the guy's name. Do you remember the composer's name?
I think Hoyt Curtin was the main guy, but
yes.
he didn't do a lot of Space Ghost, even though they had a lot of reuse from Johnny Quest and Space Ghost.
Okay.
I told about 50%, but I believe it was a guy named Bill Nichols that did the music, if I'm remembering this right.
Okay, because Hoyt was the guy I was thinking of, Hoyt Curtin, but yeah, that's I didn't realize that, because like you say, I recognized a lot of music that also was used in Johnny Quest.
Yeah, you know, back then, I'd never noticed that. Did you notice that kind of stuff that they were doing?
Oh, no.
Yeah, we didn't notice any of that back then. We just, you know, that's what's great about being a kid. You're just not smart enough to not enjoy things that are the way they are. They're delivered just the way they are.
Yeah, but I you're right, and I think as we get older and you know, can't let go of some of this stuff, then it does kind of become an interesting education to go back and find out who those guys were and what went into putting that full production together, because it did. It hit you in all senses. It was amazing, and especially for limited animation, was pretty amazing stuff to look at. And as you say, that blend of the score and sound effects, it really was a great production. It was a great cartoon and a lot better than a lot of what was, you know, going on Saturday mornings back then.
God, so well said, John. hitting you in all senses. Boy, that's a... I have to borrow that someday. That's
Feel free.
Exactly. I have such a hard time, you know. There's, you know, trying to find the right words, you know, being a visual guy. But God, I just love it when people hit you in all senses. That's exactly the way I felt. It just blitzed you. It just blew you into this, you completely were absorbed into this world that they presented. You know, I remember recently seeing some of the Mitors, and I hadn't seen those in ages.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there was always guys that were better at animating or drawing or laying out these shows than other guys. When I saw the ones that were extremely well laid out and animated well, you just tingle on all ways.
I'm with you. Did you ever talk to Alex Toth about Space Ghost and have the opportunity to meet him?
Yeah, I did. It took me the longest time to figure out that Alex Toth was not Alex Nino, because some dummy up at the Capitol office told me. The Capitol Comics office told me that it was Alex Nino that did this stuff. Well, we got our Alexes mixed up. But eventually I figured this out somehow. I don't remember how. You believe how dumb we were. But when I found out that Alex was behind all this stuff, Alex Toth, I called the guy up. And it's a good thing that nobody told me what I might be in for, because you don't really want to tell somebody, you know, that he's a grouch and stuff. So I just called him up, and I said all these great things about him, and then I dropped the name Space Ghost, and he, while still in a fairly, you know, okay mood, told me that he didn't like Space Ghost.
Really?
He didn't like it because Alex perceived the show as being just a multitude of compromises, and that the show he was proud of was Space Angel. And I said, what the hell is Space Angel?
That was a great show. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about it because I never saw it. But, you know, until right before his dying day, a friend came up to Alex's hospital room and showed him some of the old Space Ghosts. And Alex finally, according to this guy, acknowledged why this show had done so much for all these people that came up to me every year and said, I love Space Ghost.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, isn't that a great way to end a guy's life? Is not on a bitter note, but, you know, him finally being able to see something he was never able to see because it was, you know, it was his temperament and the perceptions that he had back then of all the compromises, that he would not look at it like that anymore, but he would look at it as, you know, this show really counted and what I did made a difference.
Well, I only hear nightmares about animation even today, so I don't imagine that it was much better, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And I'm curious because I loved the animation piece that you did for Nexus to kind of shop it around as a potential cartoon.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
And I wonder, with the advances in technology, if it would ever be something that you would want to pursue yourself, because, again, I understand the headaches of dealing with corporations, and sometimes, you know, when you give them something that's yours, how it can be manipulated into something very different. So I understand, I can see where he was coming from. But do you ever think about, you know, with Flash animation and the things that are going on? Because, and I mean, again, wow, that 3 minutes, that's really a great 3 minutes of action and really gives you, you know, a great look at what would be a wonderful, you know, cartoon version of Nexus.
Well, thank you. Foremost, I came to the conclusion after I was finally done with this thing that it was that the ultimate audience for this was going to be the fans, and that I was not going to pursue it as a viable thing to submit to networks and all that. I don't know, something inside me, after all the pitch meetings I've had previously in the years before, where I did go and pitch Nexus to, you know, every Joe, Dick, and Ann, Harriet's dog, that I would just, you know, back off from that and just, you know, I'm glad that moment of clarity came over me where I just stopped thinking of this as something I would try to sell. Things got a lot more relaxed, and I was able to enjoy it for exactly what it was, which is, okay, well, I wanted to see this done. I desperately, fanatically wanted to see it done, and I did it. And by God, you know, even though I almost lost the damn house, it got done exactly the way I wanted it to be. And so it remains what it is, just this two-minute DVD for anyone who wants to check it out, who might be interested in what this next thing is all about.
And you have it on your website then? And
I don't know. I never go to my website.
I saw it on, and again, the prepping for the interview, I saw it on one site, and that featured an interview with you, a written interview. And I remember, it's so funny because I remember seeing it a few years ago, and I don't know, this was, you know, earlier internet and stuff, so I don't think video ran as smoothly as it does now with broadband. But I never saw the whole thing because my damn reel player would always end up screwing up, so I never got to watch more than 30 seconds of it. So it was really great to see. So, and as you say, I can appreciate the cost in terms of animation. But you just feel that then it's just doing this, you know, 2 minutes is cathartic enough that, okay, you got it out of your system, and if there ever were to be a cartoon, this is it?
Yeah, if there ever were to be a cartoon, John, it would have to take some pretty remarkable things coming together. First of all, there would have to be somebody with money who is not greedy and a bully, because I can never tolerate that. You know, I'm just here to have a good time with this stuff and do the show the way I always saw it, which is one or two reasons why I had to do this thing the way I saw it. That means I put my imprint on it before anyone who is trying to ride some kind of bandwagon would get a hold of this thing and say, well, you know, I really have different ideas about how this thing should work. I couldn't have the slightest interest in a person telling me that kind of nonsense.
No, I understand.
I mean, who would?
Sure. Going back to the old days of Nexus, the formative years, it came in the direct market period when there were so many interesting ideas, both visually and story-wise, at first with Capital City and then with First. There were so many First creators in particular that I really appreciated, you and Howard Chaykin and Mike Grell and John Ostrander and Tim Truman. And you guys really kind of all came along at the same time, and I know regionally you guys weren't that far from each other as well, and really had this very unique voice. Luckily, the direct market was there, and suddenly comics were more than just the newsstand thing that we grew up on, and it was neat having a specialty store, kind of like a record store.
It was nice to have some alternatives, wasn't it, John?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what that period of time offered the whole business and industry of comic books is, I don't know, it was fun, one of those funny times that where things just came together, like they often do, sometimes usually at the beginning of a decade.
That makes sense.
Yeah. You know,
I think you're right about that, because I think, unfortunately, it took until the beginnings of the 2000s that, you know, different genres started to creep back and different art styles and writing styles crept back. And I think we're in a very fruitful time now where there's a lot of different styles and a lot of different ways of approaching comic books. So, I'm glad that Nexus is a part of the current generation as well, because I think, if anything, everyone caught up with what you guys were doing, honestly, back in the early 80s and having a different voice.
Well, thanks. You know, the market being what it is, whatever people perceive it to be, I was, you know, the whole idea of bringing Nexus back and reviving Nexus and the Moth, were based entirely on the idea that I believe so much in these things. These were just books that had not had their life expectancy terminated yet. They had so many more stories to tell. Nexus had many years of stories to keep going with, and God knows I had just, you know, Gary and I had just gotten going with the Moth before it was yanked from us.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, internally inside my head, I just said, well, this can't be this, no, this is not right. I have to use all the things that skills that I've accumulated and all the clout that I've accumulated over the years as someone they expect to do good work with, to come back to these characters and keep, you know, bloody well going with them. And that's what I thought about inside. And that is the internal thing that is just everything to me.
What do you think of the monthly issue? Because my fear is all the time, and I understand the economics behind it, but we're at $3 now, and even $3 is going to be a cheap comic book in the next year or so. I wonder, you know, if the 22-page monthly is the right format still to get, you know, books across to people, because, you know, I guess it depends on what you do with each issue, but, you know, I just kind of fear that maybe the trade or, you know, I don't really know what the answer is, and I wonder as a vet what you think of, you know, where the price point is now on the monthly and maybe where, you know, the business is going.
I certainly expect that whatever the answer to that is going to be, it'll make itself known within the next 10 years. And I do hear that all the time, John, about the trade paperbacks being the thing that people gravitate towards far more than a monthly kind of a book. I do the monthly books entirely based on my understanding of how you produce comic books.
Sure.
Which is they come out, you know, they come out once a month. Not in my case. They come out a lot later than that. But ideally, they would be exactly that. They would be every month you go down and you got something to look forward to. You got some entertainment to look forward to. And you're never let down because that's how I grew up. You know, every month you go down, there'd be a new Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
Guaranteed a new FF. A new Thor, a new Tales of Suspense, and that's my thinking comes entirely from the things the way I knew that reality growing up.
Yeah, I guess as you say, you're right. I think maybe it will take, you know, 10 years from now. Do you look at digital comics and think maybe that's a possible future way to go? Have you been investigating the way that people are doing digital comics these days?
Well, you know, the digital era, the tool that they have is something that people play with a lot nowadays, and investigate and invest a lot of their time in. As far as maybe it's just a generational thing, John, because everything about my life growing up was about a book in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be curious to see if, in fact, that does become far more prominent, the digital thing, without actually holding something in your hand. Because all the guys from my generation, they think kind of the same way. You know, I grew up with a book in my hand. I turned real pages.
Sure.
So that's the way we grew up, and that's the way we expect and like things. This whole other thing is something for another generation to decide as to the mounting popularity of it and where it might be going from here.
Let's talk about the specific story that Nexus is in right now, Space Opera.
Yeah.
How many issues left in that current arc?
Well, I just got done drawing 101.
Okay.
And you know, I'm so brutally and mercilessly self-critical about these books here, that you know I had to actually look back at all my thumbnails, you know, which is my way of saying I can see the whole story at a glance visually,
mm-hmm.
and decide if this thing was really okay, that it was delivering in the way that we had, that Baron and I had done in the past, and I was satisfied. I have to make my own standards.
Sure.
I have to realize my own standards every single time. That's critical, and I like it. I like it like that. That is, it's not painful. It's a challenge, and I like it. I like it being like that. And the second thing is the feedback from the people that buy the book. The people that buy the book have expectations,
mm-hmm.
and I think those are very, very important because every time that you watch anything, purchase anything, read anything. Especially if you know what the author has been capable of before and has always entertained you, you have expectations that this person better not let you down. And that's what I'm thinking about when I do Nexus.
It's changed, though, since those days of the letter page, because now there is the internet and email, and there is, I think, much more direct connection to creators than there's ever been. And in some ways, I can see that as a positive, and I can see that sometimes as a negative as well, that you're, you know, people are almost too accessible. What are your feelings?
Yeah, I feel it's important. Obviously, the fact that there are not very many actual letter columns left in comic books has indicated in some way that things are changing. I don't have that. That's one of the things about, that I like about forming this company, is I don't have to abide by rules or trends that I don't happen to feel are going in the right direction. I love the fact that I could institute a letter column again, mm-hmm. and get that vital communication intimacy going on between people that count on us to deliver good entertainment every whenever it comes out.
Have you been getting good responses? I mean, it's nice that it's back. I'm happy that it's back.
Well, thanks. I think back at all the people that wrote us, that kept in touch with us, John, during that 10-year period of nothing happening. They kept writing.
Wow.
And they would all say the most marvelous things, and I take that really seriously because I simply have to put myself in their shoes to think about, you know, some of the TV shows these bastards have canceled on me over the years that I was so into. There was a show called Nowhere Man.
Loved Nowhere Man.
Thanks. And I always look at that as the example of, the network just guillotined the show. Why did they do that?
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, that kind of stuff. And so that's the way I kind of think about it. I think about how when you see shows that good, and they're suddenly taken from you, how your life becomes lessened from what it was. And I don't anyway downplay the importance of escapism or entertainment. That's one of the most important things that people can have in their life. Its place is so vital to me to have that, you know, versus the reality of all the other things that that don't make you excited and don't make you feel that you've got a great reason to get up in the morning because you have a bad job or something that you don't like. And you know, those things are just paramount to my understanding of a balanced human brain. To be bringing Nexus back like that, my biggest concern was to not let people down in the way that the quality had lessened in any way. It had to be what it was, because that's what people expected and wanted. So I had to do it.
Well, and as you say, too, you had lots more story to tell before being canceled. And, you know, this obviously affords you the opportunity to kind of get back and tell those stories. When it comes to your art, does it take you longer now? Do you think because of keeping in mind that level of quality you want to maintain, is it tougher for you to really say, okay, the page is done? I know, speaking to Mike Mignola, he said that he has gotten slower because he really wants, you know, every page to count, and he really does kind of find himself second-guessing and worrying that, you know, he wants to maintain that great Hellboy standard. And I'm wondering, obviously, if that's the same case with you and Nexus.
Well, I'm happy to say, John, that the worrying part of it has not raised its head yet.
Okay.
The process of, you know, reading the script and doing my thumbnails, which is kind of the foundation of everything that makes the book work, mm-hmm. is still just the way it was. But I certainly don't find myself having gotten faster.
Okay.
Now, if someone said, "Rude, you know, you've got a gun to your head, you better deliver this book in a month," I don't know. I mean, I've gotten too used to working as an artist and not as a guy who meets deadlines.
Sure.
So I would say that back in the old days I had to get at least a page done a day, and I was good about that. I was pretty much made that. But my life was also a little simpler back then too. You know.
Sure. Well, yeah, now you've got kids.
I think about Kirby and all these other guys having kids, and, you know, what excuse is that, you know?
Yeah, but then again, Kirby, even, I guess, if the stories are true, and I think they are, that, you know, there's a guy that would spend 12, 13 hours a day, you know, to maintain that speed that he needed to maintain or whatever. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't think his kid, I think his kids still found enough time, and I think he found enough time to be with his kids, but I don't know how he did it.
I don't know how he did it either. But you know, I think about Jack. I must think about Jack Kirby every day. And you know, part of me, got part of the thinking is you know, Jack made me what I am. I thank God for that. And the second thing is, how in the hell did this guy do it?
Yeah. Did you get a chance?
He didn't just do it for 10 years. He did it for 20, 30, 40 years. And
yeah.
He never, ever, as far as I know, ever had a nervous breakdown or anything like that. Hell, I've had at least 2 nervous breakdowns.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, just trying to, I don't know what it is. It's obviously just a brain thing. Kirby was blessed with an Einstein-type brain where his artistic lobe must have been just enormous.
Well, and, you know, Matt Fraction and I were just talking about this on a previous episode and just marveling at how these incredible ideas that just beyond his dynamic action that he would always do in every strip, but then especially, like, as he got older and as the ideas became bigger and the landscape became, you know, more expansive and space and the cosmos was really what he was dealing with, and the ideas of godhood that were swimming in this guy's mind. And again, this, you don't want to, because you sound like, I feel kind of like a jerk saying that this was just a guy that was this lunch pail, you know, working class, you know, guy that came from a very typical American background, you know, World War II vet, you know, and had these incredible ideas of the way the universe worked.
Well, there just isn't that many Jack Kirby's in the world.
Yeah.
And I don't think they come along very often. I literally think, I remember one time I had the great honor, all these great things, where I would have the honor of being with Jack at they would have little parties for him and things like that. And I remember getting up, you know, we all took our turns standing up, all these other artists talking about why they thought Jack, or not why, it was, you know, the fact that Jack had done so much for their lives. And I got up, and I had thought about what I was going to say, and I said, well, Jack Kirby, just like Einstein and Newton before him, it was 200 years before Einstein came along after Newton, 200 years. I said, well, that's how long it's going to take for another person to come along after Jack Kirby that even begins to rival his greatness and his genius.
Yeah, wow. Did you ever, like, bring him Nexus and say, hey, really, tell me what you think? And did he ever give you any specific ideas or just comments on what he thought of your work?
You know, I never did that. It just seemed to not be the right thing to do. Not because Jack wouldn't have made comments, but because whenever I would see him, whenever I would go over to his house and interact with him, the last thing I wanted to go into was my work. I remember, there was a couple times I went over to his house that I just had, I remember one little thing that happened. I was over at Jack's house, Ross was there, of course, and a few other guys, and you know, the whole thing about people signing comics, John, is very interesting to me. You know, when we go to shows, people will routinely drop off fairly massive amounts of books at times.
Oh, yeah.
And Janelle kind of acts like my Roz. Well, she'll say, well, Steve will sign 10, and can you come back, you know, later on, and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Because before I had her in my life, of course, I would sign all of them, you know, right there at a sitting. But I remember when I decided that I wanted Jack to sign some books, I brought 2 books, and that's all I wanted him to sign. It was something from the Jimmy Olsen period.
Cool.
And I just had him, I said, Jack, can you sign to the dude, Jack Kirby? And that was it. That's all I needed for the rest of my life, was just those 2 most special books that ever influenced me. It is, if you can, you know, find 2, and only 2. But those were 2 that just were, they were in my formative years, and everything was starting to happen, and they excited me like nothing else. And I just had him sign those 2. And the other time was when I bought original art from Jack, before the price of it had just escalated to the stratosphere. And I remember always thinking back and being so proud that I paid my money directly to Jack and Roz for these pages. And, of course, they're here in my studio, and they will always be here for the rest of my breathing days.
Wow.
They will always be here with me.
What are they of?
God, one of them was a Coletta inked page from Jimmy Olsen with The Guardian. I was bonkers about The Guardian. I just was crazy about this character.
Me too, actually.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, we have a strangely similar taste.
I think so, man.
Yeah. And I remember getting that, and I just, you know, that was the Dick's pajamas, as I would call them.
I'm with you.
to get that page, it was the Guardian from, I think it was the one where Superman and Guardian were running toward us with a picture of Don Rickles on the cover.
Absolutely, I love that. I have that Jimmy Olsen. Absolutely, it's the it really is one of the craziest covers. Because
it is one of the craziest covers, and you know, I almost am tempted to go into my big spiel about that kind of comic book versus the stuff that they're doing nowadays. They are so bloody serious. They are so serious looking. You know what? I don't know what other people. Maybe I'm in a complete minority, but I'm not completely in the minority. And it tends to happen with guys my age. We do not like comic books to be so serious that it reflects the kind of material that I stay away from in life. You know, where I hear about little kids being blown up or someone being killed or raped or, you know.
Sure.
I don't want to hear about that. If I do, I can always turn on this, and this, but you know what? I never will, because I don't want to be made to feel like that. I know what's out there. I've been hearing it all my life, but I don't want to hear it anymore. And so when I think about Jack Kirby's, when you mentioned the thing about, you know, how much fun you had and how much fun I had looking at this stuff and the way the comic books are so serious today, it's a no contest to me. I mean, why would you want to do that to yourself by reading stuff that's got the qualities that make you feel rotten in life?
No, I understand. I understand.
Yeah, and when I think about that issue that I just mentioned, the Kirby Jimmy Olsen issue, I think about how the elation you feel inside yourself. This is the wonderful, great feeling from reading something that not only has the drama, you know, taken to the tens, but also just the other things that go into a story, all that goofy stuff you don't expect to see. Whoever can do something that entertains me in a way that I haven't seen before, or maybe I have seen before, but they're doing it in a different way, those guys have my allegiance.
No, I understand.
And that's what I live for when I do my bloody books for people. Nexus, The Moth, and Amazing New Tales, that's what people are going to get. You're not going to feel horrible when you get them to read them. You are going to feel stimulated, excited, and you can't wait for more. If that's the way people feel when they read my books, I have succeeded on every level that I ever set out to do, John.
I hear what you're saying. Well, let's talk about The Moth, because where did that character come from? Because I do remember when it came out a few years ago, and it had that classic background, and there was the circus element to it, and where was the inspiration behind The Moth?
That's a very good question. You know, that's also a situation of evolution going on there. Of a thing starts, it begins, and it evolves into something you never thought it would be. Because it started out as a trading card. That's all it was. It was just, you know, someone. This is back when they were just tossing around massive amounts of bread to people.
Sure.
To do things. And this was also the time when the image guys were striking it big and making vast amounts of bread.
Yeah.
Of money. And I watched it all with great interest. And I also remember, for some reason, people had these budgets that just were out of this world, and they would toss like $1,000 to create a card, even though it wasn't going to be kept by them. It was creating your own stuff, and that's literally where The Moth started. And the other character, the Silencer, was the same thing. I just, you know, hey Steve, you want $2,000 for creating two characters here? I said, yeah, okay. You know, so I sat down and I thought about these. I dug inside myself for these two guys, and that was kind of the beginning and the end, I thought, of The Moth. And one day Gary Martin comes up and just starts going on and on about how he likes this character and he wants to do this with it and stuff. And I said, okay, let me think about this, and let me get some background for the character. So then it went from the silliness that I wrote in the back of the card as far as his origin goes of The Moth to this whole background of the circus. And I thought of the circus idea because I didn't see that anywhere at all. I didn't see anyone using the circus as the dramatic backdrop for these stories. And, you know, again, as anyone who creates these things can tell you, we kind of really don't know where they come from. They just kind of, you know, I know I didn't want this, this, and this, and I had a, God knows I had a cliche meter built into my head after all these years. And I, somehow the whole idea of the circus came about. And another thing led to, one thing led to another with the whole circus idea. What it was, the idea of this, I wanted this to take place in the real world. And I thought, well, you know, the costume this guy has, I mean, what is the real reason for this? Because for some reason I was determined to not, you know, go the silly route of you know, he's got a costume because he has a costume or whatever the hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he had the costume because that was part of his aerial act.
Sure.
And I was also thinking of wrestlers at the time. You know, wrestling was getting way bigger than it ever was when I was a kid. And it just expanded into this mania, this Hulk Hogan, you know, stuff, and Andre the Giant. And, you know, they all had, and these Mexican wrestlers, they all had these crazy costumes on. And I thought, well, this is perfectly in keeping with the whole thing that I want to do here with the circus. You know, the circus seamstress had made these costumes for all these characters, and this one, this moth costume came about because of, you know, the following reason. So, you know, once my thinking along those lines ignited, I mentioned evolution. It kind of just was started there, and this begot that, and it just kind of kept going. And pretty soon we had a whole damn cast going on, you know, and I thought, well, do I want the cliches of the bearded lady and the strong man? I thought, well, yeah, of course I want that.
Sure, it's part of the
circus.
You know,
everything is in the character anyway of how you portray these guys. But if I didn't have that, people would feel like there's something not there.
Sure.
That they not only expect, but they want to see. So, you know, that's kind of a... Do you write it all, John? Do you ever create things like us comic book guys do?
Well, I won't deny that I have, my ideas like that. Most of my writing has always been for journalism and been more, you know, just covering boxing and sports and things like that as far as what I've written.
So you've never done the kind of creative writing that I'm talking
well,
about?
Well, like I said, I've got a few story ideas. I won't deny that.
Great.
So, you know, but I always feel wonderful. I feel silly saying that to someone like yourself who's really doing it. You know, I think a lot of us comic readers, you know, have their dreams and kind of have their different ideas, and it's a question of whether we pursue them or not. But no, I won't deny that. There's a few in the attic.
I think that's wonderful. There's nothing quite as inflating or elating to your sense of inner excitement than to create these things out of nothing.
Sure.
And then to find out and to realize that there is something substantial to them that makes it a worthy vehicle to actually put in a comic book and be taken seriously. There's nothing more exciting than that.
Well, that's cool. Now, what the plans for the Moth are, once Space Opera is completed, then you will start releasing the first Moth arc under Rude Dude?
Oh, yeah. Man, you ought to see the stories that Gary's come up with. It's just nuts. Oh, man, I mean, we both kind of think of the plots, but Gary writes the stories.
Okay.
And I only step in if something isn't quite as exciting as it should be because, again, my instincts, you know, they come alive and they tell me if there's something right or wrong. But, oh, my God, I mean, we ended the last issue with Dark Horse before it got canceled with a cliffhanger.
Okay.
And we had to figure out what to do.
Sure.
With a story. Knowing full well that there was an answer, we had to find the ultimate answer. So when Gary and I began uncovering the things that are, it's so funny to explain this process, but things that are, it's almost as if they're there, but they're covered in a blanket or something. And if you're diligent enough to take, to slowly peel the blanket away, you know, bit by bit, or an onion or something, it's revealed to you the dramatic craziness and excitement of what the story is all about. And pretty soon, when you're done, you've got your problem solved, like we were able to do. And there's a Zulu guy that comes at the end of the story. He's well over 7 feet tall.
Okay.
And he's Oxford educated. And he talks like an Oxford-educated guy. So I've got an English accent that we can't portray. But God, what happened? He basically comes up to the moth and says, "I'm going to kill you." And I don't know if you read the last issue, but the main thing that runs through my head when I read this stuff is, I'm a fan and I'm looking from the outside in. And if I'm excited by it, then you're on the right trail.
I got you.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, is that the thing? Do you kind of admire it as a fan and say, wow, how's he going to get out of that? And then suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm the one who has to figure out how he's going to get out of that.
Well, you know, that's the fun part. That's after all these years of being exposed to these fantastic artists at the greatest decade to ever read comics in, that's, by God, if I can't measure up to the genealogy of what I've been exposed to make my mind the way it is right now, the way I think about things, and my sense of what makes a comic book the best it can be. We've got the next four issues accounted for story-wise. In fact, I've got it all blue-penciled out.
Great.
When we got canceled, I said, Gary, just keep going with it. Let's just keep going. Let's not stop and have to restart it ourselves, you know, whenever that may be, years on the line possibly. I didn't want to do that, so I just kept going. And so all that has been worked out. I just have to, you know, draw it, ink it, it'll be inked, and letter and all that stuff.
Okay.
And after that, we already have a really good idea where the story's going to go from there. Because, you know, with all this time that we've had with the moth, we can just sit there, and we'll be sitting at the drawing board, Gary or I, and suddenly this fantastic idea will pop into our head, and we just know this is where we need to take the next four issues, beyond the next four issues.
And is that how you're seeing these stories, is four-issue arcs? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
When I think of that idea, that's, I don't know, I somehow got into this four-issue arc thing from previous Nexus stories with First and the Moth, but that's the way that it seems to be. We want to go with it.
Well, I think that's great, because I also think, first of all, I think a lot of six-issue stories, today's six-issue stories, can be told in three or four issues. So, A, as a reader, I think that's a good idea. And secondly, it seems like that would be a good collectible way to put out a trade as well, and have it at a price point that, you know, for someone to really say, here's the complete story, that, you know, they might be interested in getting it, and, you know, you could keep it at a reasonable price.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It's the format, the plan for Rude Dude is actually very simple, and that is four issues of Nexus, four issues of the Moth, one oversized issue, 68-page issue of Amazing Dude Tales, where we experiment and have fun while also putting stories of Nexus and the Moth in there.
Okay.
And then we just it's in perpetual rotation, and then at some point, which is the right point to do these things, we put out the trades.
Okay.
And ad infinitum. That's the way it'll be.
Do you have the rights to the previous Nexus arcs to put those out in trades, or is that, you know, hooked up through Dark Horse, or how does that work as far as the old stuff?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you this: the relationship that I have with Mike Richardson is just an excellent one. He's just a great guy.
That's good to hear.
And yeah, it's just completely amiable on all levels. And he wouldn't do anything to not give me what I want unless, you know, there was some business reason at the moment that needs to be just worked out.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah,
it's
great.
Well, now let's talk about Amazing Rude Dude Tales, because, am I saying it right?
No, you said it right. Amazing, actually, Amazing Dude Tales.
Amazing Dude Tales.
Gary Barton came up with it. I laughed, so I said I got to use this here.
Well, I like it. Well,
yeah.
So you say it's 68 pages, and then are they illustrated stories of just, you know, your time in the biz, or how else would you describe these non-Moth, non-Nexus stories that are going to be in there?
Well, good question. Thanks for asking. The cool thing about the concept of this story actually came from Mike Allred. And we were talking one day, and he started telling me about this grab bag madman book that he was putting out.
Mm-hmm.
And the grab bag part of it excited me, because what that word means to me is you can do anything you want. And so I started to think about that. Well, what do I really want to do? Well, let's put in Nexus and the Moth as foundational things that people will get regardless of whether they like anything else. The Silencer was a trading card that I never developed. Let's put him in there. Let's put in the character that me and Baron created called Origami, which never saw the light of day by anyone, but we've got great stories for it. Let's put that in. You can see how this is going to work, right?
Sure.
You start thinking about all these things that would never have been seen by anyone or developed, and suddenly they are going to be. So that part is just the greatest part about this whole concept of the grab bag book. And then I thought about two other things. One is a macabre story. The macabre story part of it is we had to think of a gimmick, and I originally contacted Paul Wilson, who's responsible for the great Jack Repairman books.
Okay.
And things did not gel with that, and I ended up having to find I had to go find another gimmick, another thing to make these stories beyond just a stupid, scary story.
Mm-hmm.
And what we came up with was true scary stories. And I had a story told to me that by a prison guard that I knew had to go into the first issue of Amazing Details. The story was so scary to me, John, that I actually made the guy stop telling the story before he got to the end. And I believe every word of it. Maybe I'm gullible, but you know, the sincerity in which it was delivered was pretty unquestionable to me. And it scares the living hell out of me just thinking about what he told me. And the last thing that we're going to do, which I thought was pretty clever, was to bring back romance stories.
Oh, cool.
You know, no one ever does them anymore, right?
They were
real big in the 50s and part of the 60s.
Sure.
And I just thought, well, geez, I mean, there's romance in every story that's a non-romance story.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to bring those back and see if I can make them so good that people will look at them in a way that they never could look at them before because they weren't being done like this.
Oh,
and all
great.
We've done is taken contemporary stories. This is where I want to pull things right out of the news, more or less, and invent a story around them. Like, you hear about the goofy things that teenage girls do these days where they razor blade themselves because they have some kind of psychotic problem with, not liking themselves or poor self-image. You ever
Sure.
hear about that kind of thing? Well, those are the kind of things I would read about in, like, Time magazine or something and realize they were perfect stuff for our stories.
Wow.
You know.
That's cool.
Well, no one's going to do them. I mean, DC's not going to do them. They're not going to sell them. Marvel's not going to do them. They've never done them. Except only the model, I suppose. So we're going to
do the model.
I can do anything I want. I can take any chance I want, and all I have to do is not lose the house.
That's great, man. Well, and I think, and again, I think your style lends itself to romance tales. And
well, thanks. They're all going to be done in different styles, actually, too. That's going to be part of the excitement here.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
The what can you tell us about the character of the Silencer and the character of Origami? Without giving much away, or do you want to save that for when the books come out?
God, it's probably best that I save it for the books to come out. But okay. You know, I can tell you a little bit. I mean, and it's not because I like to conceal stuff from people. I've always hated that reasoning. Oh, I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. Give me a break. You know, talk about anything you want. This is comic books, not Hollywood.
Oh yeah.
So, or the Third Reich. So,
yeah. Very true.
Yeah. The Silencer, we decided, would be a guy that can't hear.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was the first gimmick that tied in with the name. And he's going to be a black guy. Well, I'm not sure why I wanted to make him a black guy. I think I was just tired of drawing white guys all the time.
Okay.
So we made him a black guy coming back from Desert Storm or whatever, you know, they call it nowadays.
Okay.
And he came back to his hometown looking for a little time to collect himself and diminish the horrors that people come back from when they're in action. And but of course that is not to be for this guy. Another thing, John, I don't know if people relate to this or if I can explain it right, but it's freaky how the stories that that I'll write or plot or work with on Gary or Baron come directly from real life experience in our own lives. I know it's weird, but you think about when you're 18, you've lived 18 years and you've experienced that much of life,
mm-hmm.
and then suddenly you turn 30 and you've got 10 more years of life experience where all this has happened and that has happened. Well, okay, you go 10 more years, you suddenly 40, and you've accumulated 10 more years of things that can be outright bizarre at times. And they're all stored in your brain somewhere. All the things that happen to you are in there somewhere. Sometimes submerged, sometimes on the surface.
Sure.
But that's where the conviction of knowing that these stories have a foundational sense of reality to them. That's why I can pull them off with a straight face. Because for the most part, if they didn't happen directly to me, they happen to Gary or vice versa. Or something we've read directly about. And that's from all the elements that happen in a person's life, all the things good and all the things bad, all the things expected and all the things completely unexpected, you can draw from all those things. And with fiction, you can extrapolate the premise from directly from what's happened to you or something that happened, but you can just, kind of build upon that.
Sure.
That's what's so fun about this job, where you get up every day and you have to be creative. Because it never gets boring. It never gets dull. It can be very, very hard at times. And I suppose you can have days that aren't very exciting and you don't want to be doing it. But for the most part, the jobs that creative people have are the jobs that everyone else wishes they did have in life, if they don't have them.
I'm with you there. I even working in radio and making the few commercials that I do, it's a hell of a lot better than pushing papers in a bank or in an office. I know that.
Oh, and that's exactly what I'm making reference to when I talk about the people that don't have jobs, that have jobs that they don't like what they're doing. I know a female right now that she wants to be an actress, but she's not making the things happen that are necessary to make that dream happen. But in the meantime, she's got these terrible jobs that she absolutely doesn't like. And, it's just reading and listening and hearing about people's lives, real or the things you read in the magazines that you don't really know them, is, God, who can ever draw comic books or write comic books and say that they have a lack of potential story material? It's just, aren't most things that people do in the world based on the times that they live in? I mean, think about Star Trek. It was all about the things that were going on around them in the world that was taking place in 1966 through 68.
Absolutely.
And that's the best thing to do, because usually those things are based on universal truths of some kind, people truths that never change over the years because they're inherent the way people think and the way people do things. There's always going to be greedy people. There's always going to be people that want immense power. And the worst of all are the people that are greedy, want immense power, and butcher people like Idi Amin, people like that.
Oh, yeah.
What do you do with people like that in the world besides get the press? I mean, you use them as story material, story fodder for your own extrapolations of what could be.
No, you're right, and I think even the discussion of how do we allow a person like that to exist, I think is good fodder for stories and worthy of discussion in stories, and the symbolism that you take from what's around you and channel it through your stories. I always admire that kind of creativity, and I always think that's the best kind of storytelling are the ones where if you read between the lines, you know what they're talking about, and they could be talking about things that are going on today.
Yeah, that is very exciting, and it's creatively stimulating for me to call a Baron and say, hey, what about doing a story about this guy that I just read about the news here? Because in comic books, people get what they deserve. And that's what I like about comic books. In real life, they can get away with any damn thing they want. And maybe they're never brought to trial, or they never get what they deserve in life. That's just a horror to me that's just, you know, rather not contemplated too much about. But in comic books, by God, they get it.
Sure. The bad guys, yeah, the bad guys get what they deserve, and eventually the good guys win, hopefully.
Yeah, and the heroes, you know, I keep thinking about the way Jack Kirby portrayed heroes and how that, and how what he did, how he portrayed them made such an impact on the way I thought about personal behavior. It's just amazing. All these Cap stories he had where he, oh my God, Cap had to come in and rescue some plantee that was in Vietnam or something, and the guy was cracking up. He couldn't take it anymore. There was so much going on that he just couldn't handle it. Well, Cap was there not only save this poor guy, but to get himself out without being blown up into a million pieces. And when you read stuff like that, I mean, I can't think of anything that I would have rather have read as a kid that could make such a, to use the overused word, a positive impression on me. That taught me personal behavior aspects that I wanted to adapt for myself. Because I never got it from my dad. You know, I never got it from my neighbor's dad. I had to get it from Captain America.
No, that code of morality. No, I understand what you're saying. And
that's just an enormous thing to me. And I love ambiguity. I mean, look at Nexus. There's nothing cut and dry about that book.
No.
But that's the way I see real life, and because I do, there's a comfort in knowing that I'm not taking easy way outs, and Baron's not taking easy way outs for character. Baron's so good at writing about this kind of stuff that you see life as I understand it to be in reality, which is we try, we fail, but we keep trying. Why do we keep trying? Well, I don't know. I mean, there's something inside of us that makes us carry on in spite of, you know, common sense teaching us that we should just give up. And I have no doubt that almost every person that is listening to our podcast right now has experienced exactly that in their own lives. Because life can be very, very difficult sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And puts us all to the test. Just like our comic books.
Well, I'm glad that you're back and back doing Nexus and looking forward to the Moth and Amazing Dude Tales, because it sounds like you're going to be doing some interesting experimentation. And I'm glad that you and Mike are able to work together again. I mean, it sounds like you and Gary have had a very good relationship, but that's hasn't been as long as the one that you and Baron have had. And like I say, the proof is in the issues, because I think Nexus has picked up exactly where it left off and is still great. And the end result is a darn good book that more people need to be reading. So check it out. Check out Space Opera as it wraps up, and we look forward to the eventual trade of that, and the Return of the Moth, and eventually Amazing Dude Tales as well. All coming from Rude Dude Productions. Is there any place we need to direct people as far as the web, Steve? I mean, is there, you know, just RudeDudeProductions.com? Is that the...
I think so.
Okay.
Again, I don't do much visiting there.
All right. Well, and then, of course, you know, if you're not getting these in your stores, definitely, get previews and open it up and demand your retailer to bring back Nexus, because it's a gorgeous book, and it has beautiful spacescapes and interesting characters and a great story written by Mike Baron, and great art, as always, from Steve Root. Down the line, when the Moth is ready to get going, we can come back and talk about that, or Amazing Dude Tales, whatever you want to do.
Sounds good to me, John.
Very glad to have spent the time speaking with artist Steve Rude. And again, if you haven't experienced Nexus, the Moth, some of his great creations that he's done for DC and Marvel, I urge you to check them out. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. They offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget, at InStock Trades, you can find a wide selection of books by Steve Rude, including the Nexus Archives that retail for $49.95. You can get them at InStock Trades for a mere $32.47. In addition, you can find things like
the trade paperback for The Moth, which retails at $12.95. You can find it for $8.42. All waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is featured all over the internet. We're at Newsarama.com. You can get us at iTunes, our MySpace page, MySpace.com/WordBalloon, our ComicSpace page, ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon. And as always, if you have questions or comments on the show, be sure to drop me an email, john@wordballoon.com. The Chicago Wizard Convention is coming up, and of course, I'll be roaming the area. And there's going to be a podcast panel, and I hope to be part of that. More information as that gets firmed up. But until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.